Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa's National Energy Policy Institute announced a comprehensive energy policy which would significantly and simultaneously reduce foreign oil imports, decrease domestic oil consumption, and reduce carbon dioxide emissions without a major effect on either the economy or federal budgets. Titled Building America's Energy Future, A Portfolio of Promising Policies, NEPI is currently presenting a day-long conference at the university on the research behind their five final proposals, which have proved to be the most promising out of an initial 35 proposals studied over the past 3 years. Those five policies include adopting a clean energy standard, which would move 80% of U.S. electrical generation to clean energy by 2035 using a system of credits, an oil security dividend, a moderate and graduated oil tax that would be fully rebated to consumers through income tax reductions, encouraging the vehicle efficiency rules, the CAFE standards, which were adopted in 2012, encouraging the faster adoption of our heavy truck fleet to LNG trucks, converting them from diesel to liquefied natural gas, and extending policies for energy efficiency, so everything from conserving energy in buildings and appliances to end-user installation of renewable energy sources. These five policies rely on existing technology to make progress on energy goals and are designed to be politically palatable. In fact, the interaction of the elements cancels many of their costs and negative impacts. Joining me today is NEPI's president, Tony Knowles, the former governor of Alaska, who is chairing today's conference, which is currently underway at the Alan Chapman Activity Center. The National Energy Policy Institute is supported by the George Kaiser Family Foundation, which is also a major contributor to Public Radio Tulsa as well. Tony Knowles is my guest today. Tony Knowles, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rich.
The report that NEPI is releasing, the Building America's Energy Future Portfolio Promising Policy, is a result of a couple of years of research by national energy experts. And as I understand it, you really wanted two policy outcomes, reducing our foreign energy dependency and reducing CO2 emissions at the same time with the least stress and strain on the economy and consumers. And it looks like you've come out of 35 initial proposals, you're down to five that does both fairly substantially, doesn't it?
We've had surprising news and encouraging news on the energy front. These five policies work together. They actually complement each other and make it just like and make it a better policy in the whole rather than the sum of its parts. And the policies, these are not based on some political miracle or undiscovered technology. These are off-the-shelf technologies. Two of the policies we already have in effect, and the other three are things that just are common sense, will not cost the consumers out-of-pocket costs, actually will save them money on electricity and natural gas, doesn't have any additional effect on the federal budget other than programs that are already in place now to give tax incentives to renewables, and doesn't have any effect on the economy in a negative way. So it's good news all around, and we will significantly reduce our use of imported oil, and we will get on track to mitigate climate change by getting a lot lower carbon dioxide emissions in the air.
As I look at it, the potential savings looks at about 2.7 million barrels a day in 2035. Now, this is a long process, say a 20-year process or so, but a reduction of about 2.7 million barrels a day, that's roughly saving about a sixth of our daily oil consumption.
Yes, and that's a lot of oil. At the same time, we are now, thanks to technology and investment by the private sector, we're producing more oil in America. So what this does to imports is that it's not only the oil that we no longer utilize because of the policy, but also with increasing import production, we really hammer the reduction of imported oil. And people for years have talked about having energy independence, and particularly with oil, because we're dependent on a lot of nations. We had 60% of our imports were from a foreign country, or 60% of our use was from foreign nations as of about 4 years ago. And that's rapidly turning around. So by reducing our overall oil use, increasing our domestic production, we really hammer down to maybe 35-30% our dependence on foreign oil, which is good news for America, both economically.
Also, looking at the second part of the cumulative carbon dioxide emissions, you're looking at, it doesn't sound like a substantial cut, 18.4 gigatons out of a projection of about 144 gigatons in 2035, but that's 85% of the target set by the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. So that's a big drop towards the goals that have already been established by the IPCC. And it looks like you're looking at sulfur dioxide, mercury, and nitrous oxide emissions. It would also be greater than the amounts targeted by the EPA currently.
There really is good news on our air emissions with this program. And you're right, it cuts our cumulative amount of carbon dioxide in the air by about 15%. But that does put us on track with what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said that is important if we're going to mitigate our climate change to somewhere around 2 to 5 degrees centigrade. And that's important that we get on track with that now, because every day that we lose on that, we have to double up later on if we're going to keep from experiencing the excesses of climate change. And when most people think about climate change, and they say, oh, well, it's only going to be 2 degrees in for the next century. I mean, that's not bad. Hey, you're from Alaska. That's probably good news for you. But the fact of the matter is that when you have that amount of accumulation, and we have seen by some of the extremities, whether it be drought or sandy or these type of things, it's an insurance policy to keep this kind of reaction from taking place.
Well, let's talk about the five elements of the report. Explain the five elements, if you would.
Well, they're really pretty simple and direct. When we modeled them, it was 3 years ago that we modeled them out of the 35 policies and combination of policies. These were the five policies that were complementary and the most cost-effective. And it starts out with a clean energy standard. And a clean energy standard just basically says that by the year 2035, that 80% of our electric energy will be produced by clean energy, and that will be either low carbon, such as natural gas, or renewables or nuclear that have no emissions. So that's where we're going to actually really clean up the majority of our carbon dioxide, but also our sulfur, nitrogen, and mercury emissions that are very dangerous to our health. So what that will do is go a big step. That's 75% of our goal is going to be accomplished by the clean energy standard.
Can we talk about that one for a moment? Because you've mentioned that where the sources of energy will come from, what it won't come from increasingly is coal. And you're looking at probably a halving of the amount of coal being used in electricity generation. Is that politically doable? I mean, you think about, you know, places like West Virginia, like Kentucky, with a minority leader in the Senate, that they depend on coal mining. Is that politically doable?
Well, there will still be 16% of our electricity in 2035 by our modeling will still be with coal. So mm-hmm. It's not like they're doing away with the coal industry. But the coal industry 3 years ago was doing 50% of our electric generation, and it created 80% of our carbon dioxide emissions. So it is a serious pollutant. It produces about 80% of our sulfur dioxide. It's 50% of our mercury. So it is there's a cost that society is paying that's not reflected in the price of coal, but we're paying the cost. So what will happen with coal is already happening in the market with natural gas now at an extremely low price, thanks to the discoveries and the fracking technology and the investment by the private sector. It is already replacing coal, and it's down to 42% now from 50%. So it's trending in that direction anyway. It takes a matter of years, and yes, there will be less coal burned and less coal mined. But at the same time, there's going to be a real resurgence in the building of nuclear industry. There's going to be a resurgence in the building of natural gas, and a really sharp surge in renewables, wind, biomass, and solar. So that's what's going to take over 20 years, which is a moderate time period that allows for a smooth transition from one polluting industry to the other. Now, coal can also still play a role but this will be a technology that is not right now cost effective, and that is the carbon capture and sequestration of CO2 and the other emissions. It is extremely expensive now, and it still is not a proven technology. But I know there's a lot of work being done in that, and if they can do it, then and they can do it economically, they're in the play.
Now, one of the aspects of the Clean Energy Standard is a system of credits which utilities can trade. Basically, if you are aggressive in switching over to renewable forms of energy, you're going to be able to get money from some of the dirtier utilities as they're seeking sort of a cap and trade just in clean energy technologies. Is that how that works?
Yes. You explained it very well. What happens is that if, say, a plant in Indiana, which is about 90% coal-driven right now, they'll need to get credits. But they can't necessarily build the gas plant or the nuclear plant or the wind in a cost-effective way for their consumers. So they can buy from utilities that have more than enough credits. They can buy some of those credits from them. And so that allows them to produce electricity at a more reasonable cost than if they had to make a sudden major shift in the way in which that they're producing electricity right now. And what that does, it keeps your eye on the goal that is reducing the amount of carbon overall that is being put into the air, and that's the purpose. So it's not to punish any one particular utility over another one. So allowing a trade policy for credits is a very smart way to reduce our carbon dioxide.
My guest today is Tony Knowles, the president of the National Energy Policy Institute, former governor of Alaska. NEPI is holding a conference in Tulsa today, Building America's Energy Future, a portfolio of promising policy. It's going on all day long at the University of Tulsa, and I'm sure they would appreciate people popping over later on this afternoon during the afternoon sessions. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa as we talk about their five major elements to their plan, which reduces foreign energy dependency. It actually reduces oil usage over 20 years and also reduces cumulative carbon dioxide emissions over 20 years. And we talked about the Clean Energy Standard. The next one is a little more controversial. It's called the Oil Security Dividend, which is a oil tax. But the way you've structured it, it's fully rebated to consumers through income tax reductions. But you're looking at a modest oil tax to begin with that increases over time to reduce consumption.
Absolutely. And this is one of those interesting policies that I think we're putting forth. It's interesting because it actually, through a pricing mechanism, accomplishes what we need in terms of a reduction of our daily use of oil. But by returning the revenues to the consumer, this is then not a financial burden on the consumer. And then the consumer has the option of purchasing the least cost that's available. And so it really is market-driven, but at the same time, it accomplishes the goal. One of the interesting aspects of it is that when you have a tax on oil, that's a much more efficient, as economists call it, an efficient tax than an income tax. So if you use the tax revenues from the oil, and this is equivalent to about 8 cents a gallon per year, which is really a very moderate tax given the swings that we see in the price of gasoline, those revenues are then returned to the consumer by reducing their income tax rate. It will actually help the economy because that is a more efficient tax. And over the 23-year period, by the economic modeling that was done to it, it's a $117 billion boost to the economy. So this is really a win-win situation. We reduce our use of oil. It is money that is taxed from the consumer, is completely rebated to the consumer in a more efficient way. It's the kind of tax that I say is the only tax I think that Grover Norquist will actually support.
Well, you know, I'm trying to understand how that works. If I make more fuel-efficient decisions in my buying, will I actually stand to make more money, or is it a rebate of the actual taxes expended? How do you envision it working?
Well, all of the revenues that are taken in, and it will be at an increasing rate each year, will be reflected in a lower income tax. And the way in which we're suggesting that the income tax reductions be structured would be that the percent, so it doesn't punish people in lower income brackets. So that would be a higher percentage reduction because they actually spend more of a percentage of their income on fuel.
So you'd stretch the lowest rates then, if you would.
Right. So it will be maybe like a 5% reduction in their income tax, whereas at the upper end of the income tax level, it would be more like a 3.5%. Now, for somebody who doesn't pay any income tax at all, if you structure it to where that it's a earned tax credit, then actually their people will get a check for that amount of money, even if they don't make enough income to pay any income tax at all. So it is a what we call a distribution neutral tax. So it doesn't favor any level of income, one level of income over another. And if a person doesn't use much oil, if they get a hybrid car and they are much more parsimonious in their use of fuel, they're going to make money.
Yeah, ride a bicycle or walk.
Exactly. And as electric cars are becoming more and more available, as I say, it's a money maker.
Your second step goes hand in hand with something that's already in force, and that's CAFE standards, and making sure that the vehicle efficiency rules that we've already adopted continue on into the future. Because, as you well know, as a politician, there's always political pressure to lessen those rules. But if you look at what's going on in Detroit, I mean, there's been a revolution in new models of cars that are getting far more miles per gallon than you would have thought 5-10 years ago.
That has been a policy, the CAFE standards, that has worked. And clearly we are using less gasoline because our car motors are more efficient. And that's just been through rules and regulations. It's not the market-driven kind of solutions that the oil security dividend or the clean energy standard has, but it is effective and it does work. And so we're just saying that if we continue on with that, we will see the benefits from that, one, in using less oil, and it turns out that it's less imported oil because we will be producing more domestically produced oil in future years. That's all the projections point to that. So the savings then that we have from lower fuel use because of CAFE standards all come out of imported oil, and that's good news for America, both our national security and our economy.
Now, I know you did some analysis on this, looking at the impact of reducing oil consumption, because one of the reasons we have increased domestic production has been the fact that the price has been high enough to support the alternative drilling techniques. And really, I think oil men have been pretty conservative. I mean, I remember even when oil was over $100 a barrel, they were making their strategic decisions on $60 a barrel oil. And I assume as long as it stays around 100, that rate's going to creep up. If we reduce oil consumption, is that going to affect the price, which would, again, hurt domestic consumption? Or is the economist's thought that world oil demand is going to keep that price high?
You raise a very good point. And that's a market forces that actually go in two different directions. You increase domestic production, if the price of oil is high, that encourages investment, that encourages people to go places that are more expensive, more remote places, and using new technology to get it out sometimes is more expensive. So you need a high price to attract the kind of capital investment that's necessary. At the same time, a high price of oil drives down the consumer demand. So with a lower demand, too, then you might have some reduction in the price based upon that. But at the end of the day, I think particularly as you take a look at the world demand for oil, which in China and India is really driving the world use up, that the price of oil is predicted to be on the increase for the next 20 years. So it will not be enough to reduce the incentive for people domestically in America to produce more oil, but it will be somewhat of a chilling effect, and it should be on the use of it, and for people to look at the other fuel technologies.
The next area of emphasis is converting our heavy truck fleet to LNG, liquefied natural gas. Already, you're starting to see this, but really, we're going to have to build a lot more infrastructure to make that happen. What is the strategy for actually converting the national trucking fleet to LNG?
Well, the entire use of heavy trucks of diesel, and that be oil, is about 2 million barrels a day. It's an extraordinary amount of oil that is used by heavy trucks in moving goods and services across the country. So that's where there can be a lot of savings. The market is already driving and trending trucks to shift from diesel to LNG. And that basically is because the operating cost of the fuel cost of LNG is a lot lower than diesel. And that's a good business decision for the truck companies to make it. Where we give that a push is that we take the excise tax on LNG and reduce it to zero, and then over the next 10 years build it back up to what a BTU equivalent would be for diesel. Right now, LNG is taxed higher per BTU of energy than diesel, which is actually kind of strange.
That's a disincentive, isn't it?
Yes. So we're giving it a slight push by giving it a zero excise tax for the first year, and then over the next 10 years increasing the tax up to the point that it would be the same tax equivalent to diesel.
And yet isn't the cost quite a bit less? I mean, in today's dollars, isn't the equivalent BTU process a lot cheaper with LNG than diesel, or is it closer? I'm thinking of CNG.
It is for LNG, although there's certain, and one of our authors of the paper on that, who is actually an environmental advisor to a truck, one of the major transportation firms in America, did a paper on what is the business decision, what are the steps that a business will have to take to decide to use LNG. And there are a number of it. First of all, the access to fueling. So there has to be fueling stations. And there's not really very many LNG fueling stations now. So that has to be brought in. There's different maintenance that has to be done. And also the motors that use LNG have gone through real increase in efficiency, and there's a whole new set of motors that is just now coming on the market. So everything is trending to overcome the barriers that right now a company faces if they want to get the cheaper fuel from LNG than diesel. Now, not only is the fuel cheaper, but the CO2 emissions are a lot less from LNG, and the sulfur emissions and the nitrogen emissions are significantly less from LNG than they are with diesel. So we win a couple of different ways. We import less oil by using domestically produced LNG. We clean up the air because of the lower CO2 and the other pollutants we clean up from the nitrogen and the sulfur emissions. So it's a win-win situation. But the market is driving it right now, and that's good. That's the way it should be.
The final area is energy efficiency, which has been another one of our success stories. When you think of Energy Star, think of just our appliances, how much more energy efficient they are today than 5 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. And I assume it means extending the policies. And of course, the Energy Star standards are evolving, so each year the standards are higher to reach. So you continue to get added energy efficiency from your appliances.
Yes, that is a significant increase in efficiency, which drives the price down because people are, to get the same job done, are using less energy, and so their bills are lower. There's also other areas of efficiency that have been very successful. And as a matter of fact, an industry here in Oklahoma, Climate Master over in Oklahoma City, is the nation's, America's largest manufacturer of heating, ventilation, and cooling systems, HVAC systems, for homes and businesses. And it uses geothermal temperature differential between the ground, about 20 feet under the surface, and the surface ambient temperature to create heat or cooling depending on the season. And it's enormously efficient, cuts your energy bill about in half or more, and is a, given you get a 30% credit, tax credit, and that's not just tax deduction, that's a tax credit for each one of these systems that is put in. So there's a lot of people doing that, and that's going to make a big difference in terms of our energy efficiency.
Is part of that policy extending some of the tax credits that recently expired about energy efficiency on the consumer end, like, you know, everything? I know in the last round it was everything from windows to a geothermal system to putting up a solar panel or whatever. But do you anticipate that being a part of it as well?
Yes, that's what we did. And really, that's the only effect on the federal budget from all of these programs is just the continuation of the existing tax credits that is given for renewables and for energy efficiencies. That's the only negative on the federal budget of all these policies. So people that are concerned about the federal budget and making a significant change in our energy production and usage, it's not going to be a burden on the federal government, with the exception of things that are already in place today and that are being successful.
Well, it's a very interesting policy. Politically, is it doable, do you think, in your mind?
Well, I think it is. Two of these policies, the CAFE standards and the energy efficiencies, are already in effect. A third policy, the LNG for heavy trucks, is trending that way right now. So the only really new steps forward are the oil security dividend and the clean energy standard. And both of those are market-driven. You don't pick favorites. They don't provide a burden on the federal budget. They don't provide a burden on the household consumer. And they don't put a burden on the economy. So it really is a win-win situation as we regain our energy independence and as we mitigate our climate change and we clean up the air pollution that is a health hazard to so many people.
All right. Well, you can learn more about this report at nepinstitute.org. You can read the whole policy recommendations. And let's see what happens. I hope is a part of the policy to actually bring it up to Capitol Hill, to bring this to the Obama administration and see if they'll get behind some of these targets.
Rich, this is a you've expressed it very well, and we certainly hope that the goals of energy independence, our national security, as well as our economy, that's important to both parties. That's important to all Americans. Cleaning up the health hazards that some air emissions have and mitigating climate change is also, that's not the monopoly of any one party. That's something that's in everybody's interest. And if we can get that accomplished at an affordable, low cost, which it seems that we can do, then we've made some real steps forward.
All right. Well, Tony Knowles, we appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you, and thanks to the listeners.
Tony Knowles is the president of the National Energy Policy Institute at the University of Tulsa. You can learn more about their new report, Building America's Energy Future, A Portfolio of Promising Policy. It's available at their website at nepinstitute.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.